Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we've got the authors of two studies that are really worth highlighting, I think. First, we'll speak with Lee Drutman, a political scientist at Johns Hopkins and a New America Fellow, about his new study of the 2016 election. And then we'll be joined by Megan Stone, a fellow with Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy, to talk about her study on how the mainstream media depicts Muslims and refugees. It's not positive. But first, a few items you may have missed. New Hampshire has a part-time legislature. Lawmakers earn $100 a session, so they're basically volunteers. They have limited staff. And it's possible that the more severe conservatives are not the brightest bulbs in the chandelier. With all that in mind, perhaps it shouldn't come as that great of a surprise that while they were drafting a piece of anti-abortion legislation, they accidentally made it legal for pregnant women to murder people. Fortunately, writes Slate's Ruth Graham, they fixed the text, quote, mere weeks away from having an army of Kill Bill-style avenging mothers-to-be roaming the state with Uzis propped on top of their bulging bellies. In the 1980s and early 1990s, you may have remembered this. The U.S. was seized with what's come to be known as the Satanic Panic, when, as Jordan Smith described it as The Intercept, quote, accusations flew that the child care industry had been infiltrated by bands of Satanists hell-bent on brainwashing and sexually abusing young children. Smith reports that a Texas couple who were convicted in 1992, quote, for lurid crimes that never happened, were formally exonerated on Tuesday after 25 years in prison. Moral panics do have real consequences. You've probably been following this, these rising tensions in the Gulf states between Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Qatar. Well, this week, Saudi Arabia took the step of deporting 15,000 Qatari camels. Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, reports for Foreign Policy that, quote, after the deportation was ordered, thousands of camels were trapped at the border for days with little food or water. Now, fortunately, they are camels, so I think that they can, not that I'm an expert on camels, but I believe they can survive pretty well with little food or water. According to the Washington Post, Brady Dennis, quote, the Environmental Protection Agency plans on shedding more than 1,200 employees by early September through buyouts and early retirements as part of a broader push by the Trump administration to shrink a government entity the president once promised to eliminate in almost every form. That's just very encouraging. Charlena Lyles, a pregnant African-American woman who, according to her family, struggled with mental illness, called the Seattle police this week to report a burglary. She ended up being shot and killed by two white officers who said that she brandished a knife when they arrived. Lyles' family says that she had been known to police. They knew that she had mental health issues. And they don't understand why so she was a very small woman. And they don't understand why she couldn't have been managed with like tasers or less lethal force. That comes from Lynn Thompson at the Seattle Times. A black off-duty cop in St. Louis was shot by a white fellow officer on Wednesday night. He was responding to an incident, I think, near his home. And a couple of his colleagues saw a black guy with a gun. They ordered him to get down on the ground. He did. And then they recognized him and they told him, okay, it's cool to stand up. But another cop just arriving on the scene saw a black guy standing up and shot him. Fortunately, the wound wasn't life-threatening. That story comes via the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And a jury in Cincinnati was unable to come to a verdict in the murder of Sam DuBose. Again, this is the second time. An unarmed black man who was pulled over by a cop named Ray Tensing. This was such an unbelievable shooting. Tensing asked DuBose to unbuckle his seatbelt and then just immediately shot him in the head. And I'm not exaggerating. Tensing claimed that he was being dragged by DuBose, but there was video, and that did not happen. Tensing was wearing a Confederate flag T-shirt under his uniform, but the judge, who is a former Republican elected official, ruled that it would be prejudicial to allow that little fact into evidence. This comes on the heels of, as you'll recall, last week a jury found Minnesota officer Geronimo Yanez not guilty in the shooting of Philando Castile, as Castile calmly responded to orders. And last month, Officer Betty Jo Shelby was cleared in the manslaughter of unarmed Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. This one was on video. Crutcher had his hands up and appeared to be cooperating with Betty Jo Shelby, but she said that she was scared for her life. Basically, it's effectively legal for poorly trained police officers to kill unarmed black men for no reason. It's just police impunity is something that, you know, you think about in banana republics, and it exists in the U.S. in the case of jury trials for cops who kill black folks. It's outrageous. And then you hear people saying, oh, you know, give the police respect. You know, it's one thing to acknowledge that most police officers are, you know, not monsters, but given that they cover up for their bad apples, it's hard to reconcile. Anyway, on that depressing note, let's move on with the show. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Lee Dredman. Stay tuned.
I
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Lee Drutman. Lee teaches at Johns Hopkins. He's a New America fellow, and he writes all over the place. I mostly know his byline from Vox, where they nerdsplain politics to us dummies. And Lee has a fascinating paper that he wrote for the Voter Study Group. It's titled Political Divisions in 2016 and Beyond, and listeners can find it at Voter Study Group. All one word, .org. I think it calls some of the conventional wisdom around last year's election into question. At a minimum, Lee Drutman, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hey, great to be with you, Joshua.
Now, Lee, I'm gonna talk for a second just so I can remind listeners about why this study differs from others. Regular listeners will recall that we had John Sides on the show last week. Lee uses the same database, and for those who didn't catch last week's show, what makes this data unique is that in conjunction with, was it YouGov?
Yes.
With YouGov, the polling firm, they asked a series of questions of the same 8,000 individuals, both before and after the 2012 election, during the midterms, and before and after the 2016 election. So while we've seen a lot of analysis based on exit polls or voter registration data, that doesn't get into the heads of individual voters the way this does. So, Lee, I want to focus mostly on the Democratic side of this, but before we dive into that, let's talk a little bit about the divide between the parties. You write, and I quote, "The primary conflict structuring the two parties involves questions of national identity, race, and morality. And while the traditional conflict over economics, though still important, is less divisive now than it used to be." There's a lot to unpack there. Can you take a whack at it?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that made the 2016 election feel so different is that we were asking these fundamental questions about American identity. In 2012, we had a more sort of conventional election, which was sort of about the size and role of government. Those questions receded to the background, and we argued about immigration and Muslims. And if you watch the conventions back to back, you just saw two very different Americas being presented, and voters were asked to choose between those two Americas.
And you say that this has the potential to reshape the party coalitions. Has it already? I mean, let me ask you a question that I asked John Sides last week. Are we seeing the tail end of a long realignment that began in the civil rights era in the South and had not progressed linearly, but was then kind of finished off by Donald Trump's nomination and his rhetoric activating kind of racial animus and xenophobia?
Yeah, I think one way to look at that is certainly that this is the culmination of a long and slow realignment, in which once Democrats became the party of civil rights starting in the 60s, white working class voters migrated out of the Democratic Party and into the Republican Party. And what Democrats lost among white working class voters, they gained among professional class, upper class voters, as well as sort of a growing number of minority voters. What's interesting is that the parties themselves and their leadership haven't quite caught up with their underlying coalitions. And I think now the big question is whether the Republican Party in governance reflects the Republican Party in the electorate. Right now, it still is not. Donald Trump is governing as a very different candidate than he ran as. And the question is, will the Republican Party shift to Donald Trump as he governed, or Donald Trump as he ran, or Donald Trump as he's governing? And I don't know the answer to that. I suspect it's very difficult for a party not to reflect its voters for an extended period of time. But I think there's a lot of uncertainty and potential chaos, I think, ahead in the American party system. Most people vote as partisans, the number of voters who are identifying as independents is at historic highs, is particularly among younger voters. Voters don't really like their own party, but they really hate the other party. So the parties are being held together by negative partisanship. So the system feels very unstable at this moment, and I think there could be, depending on on exogenous events, economies, economic shocks, global war. You could see a very different party system in the near future.
That's reassuring.
Yeah,
and I saw some conservative commentator the other day, and I forgive me, if I don't remember who it was, but he said that Trump's governing as a populist minus the free candy, which I thought was an interesting turn of phrase, interesting way of putting it. Let's turn to the Democratic primaries. In my social media circle, I have had neoliberal Hillary bots fighting with know-nothing Bernie bros for a year and a half. They seem really, really to hate each other. And certainly we see a lot of media reports, punditry about this massive divide in the Democratic coalition. And yet you found, when you dug into the actual data, that that isn't really representative of the actual Democratic base. Your paper posits that the Republican coalition is more divided than the Democratic coalition. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, what was interesting looking at the Democratic coalition is there's not a lot of divide on ideology across a wide range of issues. Sanders voters look a lot like Clinton voters. Now, there is one area where Sanders supporters look different from Clinton supporters, and that's sort of in their general support for the political system overall. You know, the stereotype of Clinton being the establishment candidate and Sanders being the outsider candidate is absolutely true. And I mean, the party is more united on, you know, on first principles, whereas the Republican Party is much less united, I think, on first principles. But this sort of insider-outsider divide, I think, it is actually quite significant within the Democratic Party, because it's really a question over personnel. And there is a sense, you know, that I think among a lot of folks who supported Bernie Sanders, you know, that the system really doesn't work. And even though they sort of share the same ideology as Clinton supporters, they have a very different theory on how to achieve policy outcomes that would match with that ideology. And I think that this divide will actually get worse over time within the Democratic Party if it's not addressed. And it's hard to see how it will actually be addressed.
I mean, you know, this idea of attitudes towards the political establishment, it seems fuzzy. It seems like something that is not, you know, you can say, I support, you know, fair trade. I'm not into the TPP. You can say, I have a position on all sorts of issues. But what does it mean to be hostile towards the political class in practical terms? And is it fair to say that that's a tribal difference?
Yeah, I think it could become a tribal difference. I don't think it's a tribal difference now. It's a tribal difference if these rival camps come to be a source of identity. I mean, if you think about the divide within the party over who should head the Democratic National Committee between Keith Ellison and Tom Perez, both have unimpeachable progressive bona fides, and yet this was a quite bitter divide because Perez's main sin among a certain group of Democratic Party activists was that he had been endorsed by the party establishment, whereas Ellison's main credential was that Bernie Sanders had endorsed him, and this became seen as sort of a proxy war between who should be in charge of the party. I mean, the real, as consistent with the data that I analysis that I did, you know, there's not a big divide in ideology, but yet there's a sort of divide in alliances. You know, I mean, this is sort of you can think about this in terms of how Clinton and Sanders postured themselves. I mean, again, you know, not, I guess, broadly Sanders to the left of Clinton, but I think the big glaring difference was that, you know, Clinton had worked within the establishment for 30 years, and she had made compromises, and she sweated details, and she believed in incrementalism and coalition building, and didn't particularly feel it was necessary to call out names and call out enemies and name names. Sanders, you know, sort of gadfly for just been in power in government just as long, but he had never really participated in the central mechanisms of policymaking. Didn't really feel like he needed to make compromises, and was willing to name names, and, you know, didn't sweat the details. He was for, people knew that he was for breaking up the banks, and Clinton was for taking money from inside the banks. Nobody really bothered to read their policy papers because,
right.
You know, who cares about
policy
papers?
People don't read policy papers. Yes, that's true. First of all, hold on. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Lee Drutman about the 2016 election, which we all had a great deal of fun with. I disagree a little bit in terms of the idea that this has not become tribal, although I'm quick to acknowledge that there is a vocal core of people who are still fighting over this and who see themselves as Bernie supporters or anti-Bernie supporters, you know, who are Democratic stalwarts. I think most people have gotten past the 2016 election, but I think among that activist core, it is very tribal. And I would just point out that, Tom Perez was the Bernie Sanders pick for among potential vice presidential candidates just a few months before he was the establishment hack. And it was the signal of Sanders' endorsement. And as you noted, there was no difference between their platforms. They were both saying, you know, we need to have greater integration of the grassroots. We need 50 state strategies, et cetera, et cetera. But it turned instantly. He was the progressives champion for VP. And then he became the kind of establishment hack sellout guy. That strikes me as very tribal. Lee, I've seen some criticism of the questions that were used to determine this left-right axis on economic issues. The criticism is that I've seen is that they're too rough to capture the differences between these coalitions. For example, you know, just off the top of my head, like a difference between single-payer healthcare versus beefing up and expanding the Affordable Care Act, you know, which I think is a fair way to represent that particular issue, you know, that you can say, well, we all think that we should expand the social safety net, but that doesn't capture those differences. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, look, there's no perfect set of questions. And you know, the other thing is that these opinions are somewhat fluid. I mean, if you look at how Democrats feel about single payer now versus, you know, probably even just a year ago, the needle has moved tremendously.
Yes.
So look, I mean, no survey question is perfect, or no set of survey questions is perfect. I mean, I don't want to take this as any, there's no set of data analyses that are definitive, but you know, this was an index that was a number of questions, and you'd think if there were meaningful differences, they would have shown up across a number of questions.
And you found that there's a difference between Clinton and Sanders supporters on their support for trade. The trade agreements, I should say, because everybody is for trade, whether you like the agreements or not. And just to be clear so the audience understands, it's not that Sanders supporters became more skeptical of trade as a result of his rhetoric on the stump, because this data looks at people's attitudes going back before the election, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, the survey questions that I built this on were asked in 2016. So, you know, it is possible that some of this was reflecting what Bernie Sanders was saying. I think there's a large and convincing body of evidence in political science that public opinion does reflect what political elites say. There's obviously limits to that, but so it's hard to tease that out entirely. At least in the analysis that I did, I could certainly do further analysis to get at that. I mean, this was the analysis that I did. It was sort of a first cut. And there's certainly room to do more.
And on the same note, this idea that the system isn't fair, could that reflect Sanders activating or priming those views with his attacks on the millionaires and billionaires and money and politics, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, and it may also reflect the fact that if Sanders had become the nominee, it would be Clinton voters who feel like the system wasn't fair because their candidate lost. But I think those attitudes do reflect deep-seated attitudinal differences. I think there's certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence that fits with that.
Yeah. And one other thing that struck me as I was just looking through the charts is that there was this difference between Clinton and Sanders supporters in terms of their views of Islam. Do you have any thoughts about why that might be? I mean, it doesn't seem like, if you look at younger people, if you look at the more progressive people, you would think that they would have a more positive view of Islam. Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Sanders did better among disaffected rural whites generally, who may have hold some skeptical attitudes towards Islam. That would be my guess in explaining that.
What about this and I'll just throw it out there. According to the exit polls, there was basically a tie among whites, and then Hillary Clinton won people of color 71-28, I believe, according to cumulative, you know, they put together all 27 exit polls. Now, a quarter of Muslim Americans are African American, and there's this whole rich tradition of kind of liberation theology almost among radical African Americans. There's an association with Islam. Do you think that could be explain it? Just the nature of the coalitions?
It's possible. Yeah. It could be any number of factors, but it probably has to do with the types of voters who supported Clinton versus the types of voters who supported Sanders.
And as far as the coalition moving forward, what do you think are the possible maps from here? What routes do you think they could take? You said that the data show that you could see a fundamental shakeup of these coalitions. What are the kind of two main highways you see ahead for the Democratic Party?
Well, I'm not the first to say this, but I think there's sort of, you know, the question is, do Democrats want to lean into their sort of emerging coalition, or do they want to try to go back to the coalition that they had? My general take is that the Obama-Trump voters ain't coming back to the Democratic Party as long as racial and immigration issues are central to our politics, and as long as Donald Trump is president, there's a good chance they will be. So I think Democrats really need to lean into their emerging coalition, which looks younger, even more diverse, and probably even more progressive, and just, you know, really, really give, you know, really lean into that.
Give them something to vote for and take a base strategy.
Yeah.
I can't agree with you more. And I think that, you know, there's a fundamental conundrum that if as we see from an increasing amount of data, it is cultural anxiety, fear of change, fear of loss among less educated white people that is driving this shift, then the only way that you're going to get those people back is to reject the increasingly diverse coalition that's been called the Obama coalition. And that seems to me to be something that would be extremely harmful for the Democrats to do from not only a political standpoint, but also from a moral standpoint.
Yeah, I don't think Democrats can do that. I mean, half of their party is now people of color, I mean, young people. And the question is, you know, how to work with that and how to excite then that coalition. And, you know, it's the right thing to do, and it's probably the politically smart thing to do. One thing I will note is that sort of looked also at the Romney Clinton voter, the Romney Clinton voter is to the left of center on issues of race and immigration, also cares deeply about economic inequality. It's a little more skeptical of the role of government, which may suggest that going forward, Democrats should think about solutions that don't necessarily involve large government programs. And there are plenty of ways to address economic inequality without large government programs, including just better regulation. That's not big government regulation, but smarter regulation. But But yeah, I don't think Democrats need to give up on their values or to basically try to triangulate in some way to win in the future.
Lee Drutman, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. This is fascinating stuff. I really do appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be with you, Joshua.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
De causarme mal con otro chaval que conoces bien, aunque yo te quiero más que él. Has de imaginar cómo me sentí,
me sentí
encajando lo que ayer oí. Sabes, nena, son las malas lenguas murmurando que me pegas. Son las malas lenguas retumbando en mi cabeza. Dale y dale,
sí. Son las malas lenguas murmurando, ven que tú me dejas.
No es de hombres lloriquear, pero apenas puedo aguantar. Si te vas, no sé vivir. Representas mucho para mí. Trato de explicarme por qué razón me ocultaste tu corazón. Oye, nena, son las malas lenguas murmurando que me pegas. Son las malas lenguas retumbando en mi cabeza. Dale, dale. No soporto la falsedad. Por favor, dime si es verdad. Si has dado en pensar que será mejor,
será mejor
regresar con tu antiguo amor.
Dime, nena,
son las malas lenguas murmurando que me pegas. Son las malas lenguas retumbando en mi cabeza. Dale y dale, yeah.
Son las malas lenguas murmurando, ven que tú me dejas. Son las malas lenguas murmurando,
van diciendo que no, que no quieres mi amor.
Son las malas lenguas murmurando, ven que tú me dejas.
Son las malas lenguas.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. So we finally got a look at the Senate bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, the erstwhile Senate secret Senate bill. It is an utter disaster, in some ways even more extreme than the House version. We'll have a healthcare wonk on next week to talk about it in detail. But I just want to make a quick point about the politics. Here's Nevada Senator Dean Heller. He's a vulnerable Republican up for re-election in 2018, announcing his opposition to the bill.
This bill that's currently in front of the United States Senate, not the answer. It's simply not the answer. I'm announcing today that in this form, I will not support it. We have 200,000 Nevadans. We're talking those with mental health, with disabilities, mother with children, that today have insurance. Insurance that they probably would not have had 5 years ago.
Heller isn't alone. Susan Collins of Maine says she couldn't support it in its current form. Meanwhile, the hardliners, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and Rand Paul, all attack the bill from the right. It doesn't screw over enough Americans. So they can't support it. A pro-Trump PAC took out a major ad buy against Heller, because these people play for keeps. And a Senate aide told Axios this week in a telling quote, "The moderates always cave. I don't know if conservatives will cave. In the end, we could be spared by the GOP nut jobs, the House Freedom Caucus, Cruz, Lee, etc. It's possible, even if unlikely, but it's always been a good possibility. From the beginning, the key to getting this done was to make the bill cruel enough for these people to support it while offering enough coverage to keep vulnerable Republicans, and I don't even want to call them moderates at this point, from bailing." And the House Freedom Caucus, by the way, sent Mitch McConnell a letter saying they couldn't support the Senate bill if it comes back to them in the House. If you'll recall, the House version of the bill passed with a very, very thin margin. I think it was 3 votes. There has been talk about maybe Mitch McConnell doesn't want to pass anything. Maybe he worries about the backlash, wants to move on to tax cuts, and just needs a vote, even a losing vote, so they can go back to their base and show them one writer described this week as a dead body, so they can say, "Well, we tried." This would obviously be the best scenario, and if that happens, it's likely that the Republicans will stop sabotaging the ACA with the knowledge that they will own the outcome of that sabotage. In any event, it's really important to keep the heat on the Republicans right now. Call your senator, regardless of his or her party. Go to a protest. Make your voice heard. It's really, really important. We just need 3 defections in the Senate, whether from the left or the right, and the whole thing comes crashing down. And with that, let's move on. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Megan Stone. Stay tuned.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But the boys with expert timing. There was Funky China Man from Funky Chinatown. They were chopping them up, they were chopping them down. It's an ancient Chinese art, and everybody knew their part. From a painting to a slip and a kick in from the hip, everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But the boys with expert timing. There was Funky Billy Chin and Little Sammy Chung. He said, "Here come the big boss, let's get it on." We took the bow and made a stand. Swinging with the hand, and his motion made me flip. Now we're into a brand new kick. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kicks were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But the boys with expert timing. Was a little bit frightening. For the boys with expert timing. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. For the boys with expert timing. Everybody was kung fu fighting.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Megan Stone, who is a fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Megan released a study this week titled "Snake and Stranger, media coverage of Muslims and refugee policy. And listeners can check it out at shorensteincenter.org or just Google snake and stranger and maybe Muslim, and I'm sure it'll pop right up in your results. Megan Stone, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time. Before we dig into the details, what was your big picture finding here?
The big picture of looking actually at the quantitative analysis of TV news coverage is that it's overwhelmingly negative on both the Muslim community and on the refugee communities. And what we looked at was a selection of network TV nightly banner broadcasts from CBS, NBC, and Fox to look across the landscape about how are we talking about the Muslim community, how are we talking about the refugee community. And what we found looking at a two-year period from 2015, before then-candidate Trump announces his intentions to put in place a Muslim ban, all the way through March of 2017, after he announces and implements the ban, was that the coverage was negative throughout. It was never in the positive territory on these communities. It was always a question just of how negative was it. And when we dug deeper to see, well, when we do talk about the Muslim community in American TV news, what do we talk about? We found that ISIS, by far and away, is the predominance of the coverage. It's about 75% of the coverage when you discuss the Muslims in the Muslim community is about Daesh or ISIS. They are the protagonists, specifically in about three-fifths of all the Muslim stories, plus other militant groups that account for the rest. And so what we found is that it's exactly what the community has been saying, which is that anytime an everyday person is watching the news, which they feel is trustworthy, this is the mainstream media. This is not the alt-right. This is not fake news. This is, you know, trusted media outlets, you know, from one side of the aisle to the other. This is what they're communicating about the community. And it reflects what we've seen about how Muslims are depicted in entertainment, you know, media as well, whether that's Homeland or 24 or movies, you know. So we're seeing this again in mainstream media. And so, you know, the reason I wanted to look at this was because when the Muslim ban got announced, you know, they did polling shortly thereafter. And, you know, ABC News and Washington Post found that 36% of Americans and 59% of Republicans believed that the Muslim ban was the right thing to do. And so, you know, for me, the interesting question was, how did we get here? You know, how can we get to a place that an everyday American, over a third of Americans and more than half of Republicans, would say that this ban made sense? Like, what have they been told about this community? What have they learned about Muslims and the global Muslim community that would let them accept this so easily? And I think what the study has shown is that it's hiding in plain sight. You know, it's how the mainstream media talks about this community is incredibly biased.
I can't stand the coverage of Islam in the mainstream press. And I think it's an important point that you make, that this is not Breitbart. This is not Drudge. This is not the Daily Mail. You're talking about trusted media outlets. Have you noticed that there appears to be like moderate Muslims and Islamic extremists or radical Islamists? And there's nothing else. There's no other labels that are ever affixed to Muslims, and liberal Islam or progressive Islam, which certainly exists, is never mentioned, right? I mean, among American Muslims, I'd just point out that they're more likely to identify as liberal than the population as a whole, according to Gallup. And that whole, you know, the entire liberal left side is just erased entirely. Tell us a little bit about your methodology. I assume that you didn't go and read every report over that two-year period.
So actually, it was quite intensive. We worked together with a group called Media Tenor that does really excellent work, and they reviewed all of the nightly news broadcasts from the three outlets, from Fox News, from CBS and NBC. And any time that a specific person was Muslim or the Muslim community or that word was mentioned over that two-year period, watched that coverage and coded it for sentiment. So is it positive? Is it negative? And then who's speaking and what is being spoken about? You know, and what we found by doing that intensive analysis is we were also able to see who is speaking when we are talking about the Muslim community. And what we found is that Muslims themselves only speak in news coverage 3% of the time. 3%. So 97% of the time that we're covering a community, other people are speaking for them. So we looked at the question of, well, then who is speaking for them? And the de facto spokesperson for the Muslim community and Islam, based on the amount of coverage given to these three TV news broadcasts, is actually Donald Trump. He is given seven times more airtime talking about Muslims than they themselves are afforded to speak about their own faith, their own affairs, their own perspective. And so 21% of the time it's President Trump. And then the other 68% are journalists, you know, and I think when you look at who are journalists, often they are not Muslim or from the community themselves either. And that doesn't mean that journalists can't cover other communities. And it also doesn't mean that we can't talk about terrorism or talk about Daesh or talk about Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab. We should absolutely cover those instances of terrorist activity. We should talk about, you know, extremist ideologies, and we should do everything we can to fight back against them. But what this presents is a really loaded and biased and imbalanced picture where a community of over 1.6 billion people are constantly put through a frame and a perspective of terrorism and extremism. And this causes great pain and consternation, and I would argue real life impact to the Muslim community, both here in the United States, our fellow Americans, who are Muslim American, who we've seen through work from the Southern Poverty Law Center, from even the FBI themselves, saying that hate crimes and hate groups against Muslims are on the rise, in some cases three times as much activity since President Trump's inauguration. And even then we see what's happening with refugees, people fleeing, you know, conflict in Syria, been through tremendous trauma. You know, I've spent a lot of time in refugee camps with Syrian families, with girls, with their mothers, with those families who just really want a chance to rebuild their lives. And the disparity between the reality of when you sit with those families and how they're presented in the media in the United States is striking and has to shift.
What was the precise number? How much positive coverage did these big media outlets devote to Muslims in your study period?
Well, it's a very easy answer, none. There was never a quarter over the 2 years where there was positive coverage that outweighed the negative. It was only a question of how negative was the coverage. So there was at no time over the last 2 years that either refugees or Muslim community was depicted more positively than negatively across those three networks.
But they had some positive coverage, right?
But the majority of it is negative. So what that means is that there was no noticeable positive coverage overall. What I found is that, you know, if you look at refugees as an example, what you would see every once in a while would be a human interest story. You know, and this week is a great example. It was World Refugee Day, which is so important, right? We saw incredible activism and energy on social media, you know, people sharing stories and sharing content that's uplifting. But what I would argue is that doesn't stand much of a chance when the rest of the year is depicting this community as dangerous and through a perspective of terrorism. So there was one other striking finding we found, which is that sometimes, you know, NBC and CBS would run a little bit of positive coverage. Usually that would be a human interest story. It
right.
would be, you know, something that shows somebody from the Muslim community or somebody that's a refugee as a human being, you know, as somebody that's really overcoming impossible circumstances through resiliency and strength. But that's very rare. What we saw on Fox over that two-year period is that they did not run any of this kind of content, a negligible amount of content that depicted refugees or Muslims as productive members of society. Or even
human beings, really. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's remarkable how skewed it is. So let's just review. You have a whole range of human endeavor, but the coverage of the Islamic community was dominated by stories about strife and terrorism. And despite the fact that the majority of victims of Islamic terrorism and warfare are Muslims, right?
Exactly.
I mean, they didn't have a voice in this.
The statistics you're citing are from a U.S.-funded study that shows that the overwhelming victims of terrorism are Muslim. And I myself used to work for Malala Yousafzai, who, you know, as many people know, was attacked by the Taliban. She herself,
yes,
an observant Muslim. So,
yes,
you know, this is very much the case.
And then that stunning finding, Donald Trump, one particularly toxic Islamophobe, spoke seven times as many words about Islam as all Muslims combined. If you're just tuning in, this is Joshua Holland. I'm speaking with Megan Stone about her new study on how Muslims are depicted in the mainstream media. Now, here's something. You did not look specifically at how many anti-Islam activists were featured in coverage of Islam. You list Muslims and Trump and reporters and other, as far as the shares of voices who are speaking. And I have to imagine that a fair chunk of other, the other category, was the like Pam Geller, Robert Spencer types, the professional Islamophobes who really make an industry out of that. I wonder why you didn't look at their portion of the coverage. Was it just limitations in the data?
Well, I'd say it's two things. One is, the first thing I want to say is that you're completely right about the impact those groups have had. And I really want to commend colleagues like Yasmin Tev and Wajad Ali, who both worked on two reports at Center for American Progress called Fear Inc. and then Fear Inc. 2.0. And it was really a very clear and very damning explanation of the business of Islamophobia in the United States, how these groups produce a whole series of fraudulent reports, xenophobic conferences, candidate forums, how they invest in pushes like bills against Sharia law, which is not a threat in the United States and will never be, and is not at all going to shake the foundations of our American system of rule of law and justice. And they have pushed these efforts, and they have absolutely shaped the coverage. So Pam Geller and others are not booked as much as they used to be on TV and in other outlets. They are still at times. We did actually do some informal searching. They still do get booked at times. They don't get booked as much as they did previously. And I would actually credit the work of Center for American Progress on the Fear Inc. reports for helping shine a bright light on that, and that research actually can change things. But that doesn't mean that their efforts haven't continued to have a real impact on the conversation in the United States and on lawmakers' positions and on ultimately creating this atmosphere that is toxic, that creates policies like the Muslim ban. So they are very active.
They're also extreme examples. So, I can see, and I'm not thinking about anybody specifically offhand, maybe like a Steve King, a representative from Iowa, that kind of person mm-hmm. represents their viewpoint quite well, even if they don't have the stigma attached to them. When you talk about Pam Geller, of course, she is seen as an Islamophobe. Those voices still resonate in the discussion from various lawmakers, various, newsmakers. Now, you mentioned that the vast majority of voices in stories about Islam were reporters, right? And I've written quite a bit about this topic, and I had to do a lot of research to get my facts straight. I wonder to what degree general interest reporters, that is, reporters who aren't on this beat necessarily, talking about this subject, reflect the larger cultural views of Islam. You mentioned in the study some polling on Americans' negative views of the religion. Do you think there's anything to that, like there's a vicious cycle where the media portrays Muslims in a negative light, and then that filters back to reporters, and then even though they're not trying to do it, they kind of reflect that same negative viewpoint?
I think what you just really masterfully described is what bias is, right? It's something that oftentimes those who are not in a disenfranchised group continue to engage in without even being conscious of it at times. And I think that's why studies like these are really important, because it gives us a quantitative space, not I feel like you're doing this, or I'm sad that you're doing this, or I'm upset that you're doing this, which, by the way, are completely valid reactions from the community and from those that want to be allies to the community. But right. It's a quantitative, it's a numeric-driven analysis to say, look, when the numbers are this skewed, clearly bias is being brought to this topic, and what you just described is exactly the case. There are journalists who may be well-meaning that are bringing the bias and the toxic environment to their coverage without even realizing how it's coming into the picture.
And even if you just focus on terrorism, just the act of focusing on terrorism skews public perception. I mean, that alone, even if you're, even if you don't have evil intent or a malign intent, that has an effective impact. Now, let me ask you this, we don't have a lot more time, but you mentioned that even when religious affiliation is not mentioned, there was similarly negative coverage about refugees. So here's my question.
There is.
Go ahead. What?
No, I was just saying there is.
Yes. Okay. So another Shorenstein Center study recently came out using media tenor data. It found that the mainstream coverage of Donald Trump was overwhelmingly negative. And a lot of conservatives cried foul, and they said that this shows liberal media bias. But I wrote about that, and what my argument was that if you look objectively, there's not a lot of positive stuff to report out of the first 4 months of the first 100 days of the Trump regime. They haven't had a lot of successes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, when you think about the similarly negative coverage of refugees, of course, being a refugee is horrible. The fact that you have people dying in transit is horrible. So I wonder how much of that negative skew results from the topic being a tragic one. If I'm coding and I see, you know, a story about a child dying, that's a negative story, right? And yet that's what's happening.
So I think that your point is an important one to really consider. And I'd say two things. One is that if you're only telling negative stories, that has a huge impact on policy, on funding, and on the perception of the community. So, you know, for all of the tragic circumstances that are happening with refugees through migration or, you know, all of the stories even around terrorism that pertain, for example, to the Muslim community, those are stories that need to be told. But when we don't tell the story of how humanitarian aid is overwhelmingly working, when we don't tell the story of how, you know, those aid dollars from the U.S. are actually saving and changing children and families' lives on the border of Syria in camps, when we don't tell stories that, you know, some of the most successful entrepreneurs in the United States who have founded some of the biggest companies that have contributed to our economy are actually refugees, then we're missing the story. You know, I had one of my research assistants, you know, I had three incredible Harvard Kennedy School students. It was a very diverse team that worked together on this. And one of the students who's contributing, who's Muslim, said, you know, I never see anybody on TV, just even as a talking head, who is Muslim, unless it's about security or terrorism. And she said, I don't know why we don't ever see even somebody booked on TV to talk about recipes or cooking or books or science, you know, or anything else. And so, you know, I think we can apply the same frame to it that the African-American community has said for a very long time, right? So, you know, during the 80s, if all that was being covered in the 90s was the drug war and the crack epidemic, and that's all you saw on TV, you know, from the African-American community, it's not so hard for the everyday person to watch that and take a very skewed perspective away of that community that is inaccurate and, I would argue, unjust and unfair. You know, where meanwhile, so many other African-Americans are, you know, being upright contributors to their families, to their communities, to their places of faith. They're leading, they're learning, they're working and leading in schools, they're, you know, helping the next generation thrive, but those stories don't get told. And so it's not that we don't want to tell, you know, terrible or even tragic stories to inspire us to action. We should look at the reality of what's happening. But if that's all that you're communicating, you're part of the problem in terms of presenting a very one-dimensional view of that community.
Megan Stone, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your attention to the work, and I hope it continues to inspire an earnest conversation and some changes in newsrooms.
Folks, the study is called Snake and Stranger, Media Coverage of Muslims and Refugee Policy. Check it out at shorensteincenter.org, all one word. I also want to thank Lee Drutman. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or let's see, wherever else you can find it, there's a bunch of places. I'd like to thank Heather Digby Parton, the good folks at Crooks and Liars, and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. You can write a nasty email to me at politicsandreality@gmail.com. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.